Before we get started today, I wanted to talk about my favorite prenatal supplement. It's by Needed. Needed was created by two moms and nutritionists who knew women deserve better. Their products are third-party tested and support women before, during, and after pregnancy. And guess what? Even dads too. Our community gets 20% off your first order with code VBAC, V-B-A-C. At thisisneeded.com. If you are taking a prenatal already, that's okay. I encourage you to listen to episodes 109 and 406 as we talk with Needed's co-founder, Julie, about what you want in a prenatal and if you are finding that your prenatal is just not cutting it. Just like a provider, it's never too late to change. All right, women of strength, let's get into today's wonderful episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the VBAC Link. It is so hard to believe that we are getting down to the bottom of 2025. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and we have our final November episode coming your way today. We have our friend Katie on the show sharing her VBAC story after quite a lot of things thrown her way through two previous pregnancies before this. Her first pregnancy, she was very, very, very sick. And the second one, very sick as well, and had a whole bunch of other hurdles and ended up in a cesarean, where then she went on to have her third baby with some other hurdles, but had her beautiful VBAC. So I just cannot wait for you guys to hear her stories and all the things that she had done and gone through pregnancy. We haven't had a ton of episodes on the VBAC Link sharing about cholestasis, and today that is one of them. She had cholestasis, which is a diagnosis based off upon symptoms elevated in total bile acids on blood work, and it can impact the liver and show that there's maybe some liver dysfunction. So in some patients or some people, it will start by itching, like of the hands and the feet. And she's going to go into it a little bit more. And icpcare.org is such a great resource. We're going to have that in the show notes, along with some other amazing resources for you guys. So if you know someone that has cholestasis or has had cholestasis before, or if you are experiencing some of these symptoms, definitely check these resources out. You'll hear in Katie's story how she did have to kind of take it upon herself to really dive in and get educated, because even though there was some information being given from her team, her medical team, there was a lot of information being left out and things that she kind of had to do to take her own care in her hands. So I'm really, really, really excited for you guys to listen to her beautiful stories. But I wanted to share something that she actually shared in her intro intake form instead of a review today, because I feel like it's something that can connect with so many people when we have gone through pregnancy and labor and birth that maybe didn't work out the same way that we maybe thought. So in the beginning, she says, of her intro, she says, "I thought birth was something you could take a hospital course on and all would go smoothly. You always hear your body was made to do this. So what could go wrong?" And when I read that in the very beginning, I thought, well, that's where I was. That's totally where I was. I downloaded what to be expect when expecting app or whatever that thing was and followed that and thought that would be good enough. But if there is anything this story or this podcast has shared, that it really is not. So I wanted to also guide you guys to our blog at thevbacklink.com/blog. We have so many blogs that cover so many amazing topics. And of course, around VBAC and CBAC and even maternal assisted cesarean, shares other people's experiences and even goes over kick counts, which we're going to talk about this today in this episode as well. So you can check that out. But go ahead over to thevbacklink.com/blog and check, or just thevbacklink.com, and click on the icon blog, and you can start reading a lot of information and start learning more about the studies of, can VBAC be induced? Or, you know, with cholestasis, she had to kind of really fight and find the right provider to be able to induce her. So many things are possible, but it's easy for us to just kind of go along with the flow, or like she said, like take a hospital course and think, okay, all will go smoothly. But there's a lot more that we kind of need to do. And as far as educating and really inspiring ourselves to feel empowered to use our voice and feel confident in our own birthing experiences. So without further ado, I'm going to get to the intro and then turn the time over to Sweet Katie.
Hi, my name is Megan. Welcome to the VBAC Link podcast. I am a VBAC after 2 C-section mama, a wife, doula, and VBAC educator. This podcast was created to hold space for those wanting to know their options for birth after cesarean. It is a space where you will likely find yourself getting better educated, relate to stories like your own, and finding the inspiration to help you have a better birth experience. Although we will be sharing stories related to cesarean and VBAC, this podcast is for anyone and everyone who wants to receive evidence-based information and learn how to avoid unnecessary or undesired cesareans. The purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. It is not meant to replace advice from any other medical professional.
Okay, Ms. Katie, welcome to the show. Before we started recording, you kind of talked about all like the complications and things that you've had during pregnancy. So I would love to turn the time over to you and let you tell everybody all about those. I think a lot of the times when we're listening to episodes, we're just like so focused on VBAC or, you know, and they forget sometimes that there's other things that come up in our pregnancies. And sometimes pregnancy isn't just a smooth journey. And yours definitely wasn't.
Yes. So, I'm a testament to that.
Yes. Yes. So feel free to share any information that you may think, you know, will help the listeners, because there's someone out there that I'm sure that might run into the stuff that you ran into.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm happy to be here. So I have 3 kids. So I'll start with my first pregnancy, which in comparison to my other two was relatively uncomplicated. I did experience, you know, pretty severe vomiting and nausea from the start of that pregnancy. I kept going back to the doctor and I was so exhausted. And they would tell me, you know, you gotta rest, eat more protein. We got to get you to the second trimester. You'll be feeling better by 12, 13 weeks. We'll get Zofran if we need it at that point. We try to hold off. I am a pediatric physical therapist. My job is very physically demanding. I was struggling at work. I kept going back to the doctor, like, I cannot make it through my day.
This isn't sustainable for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a first time mom. You hear about morning sickness. I didn't know that if this was normal or mm-hmm. I kept being told, it's part of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I get to second trimester. I'm like banking on feeling better. Nothing changes. So they finally start me on medication. The Zofran wasn't enough. I had to be on, I think, 3 different medications just to stop throwing up. And that did last my entire pregnancy, you know, but other than that, looking back now, I'm like, other than that, everything else was smooth. The baby stayed healthy the whole time. I had no other major complications and nobody ever said hyperemesis at that time.
I was going to say, did anyone ever give you the diagnosis? And did you ever get to the point where you're dehydrated enough, had to go in and get?
So not with this pregnancy. Okay. Yeah, not with this pregnancy. I will talk about that a little more.
No one said anything vomiting like that and being so sick the entire pregnancy.
Yes. Yeah. And as soon as I gave birth, felt immediately better.
Yeah.
But yeah, nobody gave me the diagnosis. So people would ask me because they knew I was so sick. Do you have hyperemesis? And I was like, well, nobody said that. Like, I feel like I do, but nobody's giving me that diagnosis. So I get to 39 weeks with this pregnancy. I go in for my 39-week appointment and my blood pressure was like slightly high and it hadn't been the whole time. So 39 weeks, what do they do? Send you to triage to be monitored and say, you should probably just be induced. You're 39 weeks. And me being miserable for that entire time, still vomiting, I was like, yeah, sign me up. Get this baby out. I am sick of being sick. Sign me up. And, you know, at that point, I had prepped a lot for like taking care of a baby because I didn't know how to take care. I took courses on like newborn courses. I took my hospital birth course, which, you know, how those go. It wasn't super helpful. So I didn't know. I was like, yeah, sign me up. We did all of the things. First time mom, it was a very long process, but overall it went smoothly. When I started pushing, my epidural was very strong and I couldn't feel anything. So I pushed for about an hour and she started having heart decels and he finally started threatening, I'm going to have to use the forceps or a vacuum. The baby can only tolerate this for so long. And I said, turn my epidural off. I think if I can feel it, I will be able to get her out. I can't feel anything right now. So as soon as I started to be able to feel again, I pushed her out. I didn't tear. So I had a very, like, overall, it went smoothly for how a first time induction would go. So postpartum, this was in March of 2020. So I know a lot of fellow people that shall share on this podcast have given birth during COVID. Yeah. That was right at the beginning of COVID. So I went into the hospital to have her at day one of that 2-week shutdown from COVID. So, you know, we were in the hospital right after she was born. The pediatrician comes in and says, you know, we usually tell parents that they need to socially distance for those first 2 months anyways to keep their baby safe. But now it's super important. And if your baby gets this, we don't know what'll happen. If she gets a fever, you'll have to go to the ER, you know, the things that they do, but they were really like fear-mongering.
Really fear-mongering.
So you have to go to the ER and get a spinal tap and do this and this. And
gosh.
I was a first time mom and I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to protect my baby. Yeah. So, you know, that started my like postpartum anxiety from the get-go. And then we were very isolated. You know, I call them prison visits. I held my daughter up to the window for people to see her. So because we were just so scared at that time, nobody knew what was going on. So.
And you've been told some really scary things.
Yes. I was like, I can't believe, looking back at it, I'm like, oh my gosh, they really scared me. And so, you know, that was going on. So I was dealing with some postpartum anxiety and first time mom, I had a hard time separating from my daughter. I didn't do anything without her. And I did not prioritize myself at that time at all. Like, didn't take time for myself. And at that point, I was not seeking therapy or anything. And I was also having really bad back pain. I went into my 6-week appointment and told my doctor, like, my back is hurting so bad. I can hardly walk at the end of the day. I can't get down on the floor with my daughter. Like, I'm having to take ibuprofen every day because my back is hurting so bad.
Like lower back or upper back?
Yeah, it was my lower back. And he said, his response was, I'll just keep doing Kegels. You'll be fine.
What?
I know. So like, I told
I'm
you.
I'm not walking at the end of the day. Yeah. I don't know if Kegels would be enough.
Yeah. I told you I'm a physical therapist. And I was like, well, I know that's not the case. So I referred myself for pelvic floor physical therapy. I'm thankful that I had that knowledge.
Good for you.
Yeah. So I went and, you know, I am a physical therapist, but I work in pediatrics and we get maybe an hour lecture on pelvic floor in school. So that was not my specialty. So I went to pelvic floor PT and they helped me so much. I ever since have preached to every mom that I know, you need to go no matter what's happening, just go get checked to be the best you, even if you're not having pain, just. So that was kind of my journey for the first and, you know, still dealing with the anxiety of all of that. And just, you know, I was frustrated with how that experience went. Because me and my husband have always wanted multiple kids. And I was like, that was so hard to make it through that pregnancy. I don't know if I'll do it again, but I can't even think about it right now. Well, little did I know, right before my daughter turned one, I found out I was pregnant unexpectedly with I call her our surprise, our fun surprise, which we love her. And, you know, it happened for a reason. I'm so thankful that we have her. Don't know what I would do without her, but I was not mentally prepared to go through all of that again.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took a little bit of, wow, I can't believe this is happening. I cried because I did not think I can't go through 9 months of vomiting every day again. Mm-hmm. And so again, started the process. I was still nursing my daughter too. So I just had not gotten my body back yet. I still was very much in that space of everything I'm giving is to you. Mm-hmm. So that was a very big surprise. And again, started with the extreme nausea, vomiting really early on. I lost a little bit of weight at the beginning, but it was only like a few pounds. It wasn't enough for them to be like, oh, this is really bad. I kind of got the same response, you know, which we're going to try to get to at least past 10 weeks, if not 12 weeks to start Zofran and other medicines. Just try to take it easy. Try to take it easy when I have a 15-month-old or newly 1 year old at home. And my job is physical. And so, you know, again, I made it to second trimester. Everybody's like, oh, just wait till you get to this week. It'll be better. Just wait till you get to this week. It'll be better. It never got better. Again, I had to do the multiple medications and I was still vomiting. I would wake up in the middle of the night throwing up. Even with this, I was able to keep food down enough to grow the baby and gain weight myself. But, you know, I was just miserable. And so then other than that, I get to 27 weeks and everything else was normal. Baby looked okay. At 27 weeks, I was sick with some kind of virus. It wasn't COVID. It wasn't the flu. They tested me multiple times for both. So just an upper respiratory virus. I wasn't super sick or anything, but right after that, I started with a heart arrhythmia. So I had maternal tachycardia. So my resting heart rate was at about 120, 110s to 120s.
You're resting?
Mm-hmm. I would lay down, be laying down, sleeping and wake up and it would be resting at that. And then, you know, I would
constantly
get up.
Constantly working out.
Yes. Yes. That's what they were like. It's like you're constantly running on a treadmill right now. That's what they would say. And I would get up to shower or walk across the room, go up one flight of stairs and it would skyrocket to like 160s. Oh, I was, out of breath doing anything. Mm-hmm. So at this point they were like, well, you need to rest. And they took me off of work because I couldn't, if I was sitting at a computer. If I was sitting at a computer, I could have done my job, but that's not what I do. So they took me off of work that at the beginning, because they didn't know what was causing it, they sent me to the ER twice because they thought I might have a pulmonary embolism. I had to get like a CT scan and all of that. Luckily, that was not the case. They ruled out all of the big scary causes. Eventually, I got in with a cardiologist and then maternal fetal medicine cardiology clinic. And their best guess was that I had a post-viral syndrome that irritated the lining of my heart, which was causing that to happen. And it was just exacerbated by my pregnancy hormones. So that was kind of the answer that I got. And they tried different beta blockers and things. Nothing brought my heart rate down. So then with this pregnancy, I get to 33 weeks and I wake up one morning with excruciating pain on the right side of my uterus. I could pinpoint where it was, but my uterus was like rock hard. Baby wasn't moving. I call the OB and they're like, come in right away. What are you doing? Like, why are you even calling us? And I was home alone with my daughter. It was like 5 a.m. My husband had to leave early for work that day. So I'm calling him like, you need to come home and take me to the hospital, calling my parents to come watch my daughter. So I get to the hospital and I'm in preterm labor when I get to the hospital.
So you're in a contraction. Is that what you were feeling?
Yeah. Yeah. And so by the time I got to the hospital, I feel like I was having regular contractions like every minute to 2 minutes was what they were. And I was like, I didn't even feel the control. Like I was just like, it was rock hard at the beginning. Like it wasn't relaxing at all.
Yeah.
So they did an ultrasound while I was there and I could, like I said, I could pinpoint where the pain was. And so they really looked at that spot and they said there was a spot on there that looked like a minor placental abruption. Mm. It was very small and I wasn't bleeding or anything and it self-stabilized. So good. But like in that situation, that was the best outcome. So that they assumed that happened, which sent me into preterm labor. So I was admitted. I spent, 3 days in the hospital, maybe on magnesium, which anybody who's done that before.
Made you feel real crappy.
Yeah, miserable. I remember it really dropped my blood pressure too. I think I passed out at one point. It was horrible. But it was successful. So it stopped labor. I was able to go home. But this time they were like, okay, now you really need to be on bed rest. Like they said, maybe 10 minutes of every hour you can get up, make yourself a sandwich. Well, that was their example.
Go make
yourself
a sandwich and go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was really hard for me. I had a 15-month-old. I am a very active person. I enjoy working out, you know, that's something that I really like doing and is good for my mental health. And so I was having a hard time at this point. Still vomiting, still dealing with that. I was put in high risk. So I was doing, you know, the twice weekly non-stress test, the weekly ultrasound, weekly OB appointments. And yeah, so I also, they were doing like 24-hour urines on me, which those are annoying to do. Have you ever had to experience that?
Yeah. That is annoying.
And they discovered I had proteinuria. So I had like levels in my urine of protein that were preeclampsia levels, but my blood pressure didn't match. So I didn't get diagnosed with preeclampsia, but they were like really closely monitoring my blood pressure because of that.
Wow.
So I just had a bunch of weird, like my body was doing something weird and.
Yeah, I wasn't happy.
It wasn't happy. I was not doing any type of mobility or any preparing my body for labor because I was just trying to get through the day, taking care of my 15-month-old and being on bed rest.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very hard time.
Yeah.
So then, of course, I went into preterm labor and then we get to 39 weeks and I still haven't had this baby. And I am like, I'm done. Get her out of me. I'd been induced the time before. I was expecting it to be long, but I was like, I can't do this anymore.
It should be faster.
Yeah. That's what they kept saying. It's like, oh, your second's so much easier. It'll be faster. Like, let's do it.
Could be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at 39 weeks, I went in for a scheduled induction and I went in on a Sunday evening and they started, you know, the Cervidil. And then I think the next morning they did Cytotec. And then eventually, I want to say the next day at like one or two, they started Pitocin.
Mm-hmm.
I was only 3 centimeters once they started the Pitocin. So I only lasted until, as I have in here, 5:15 until I requested the epidural. I had not prepared any coping mechanisms. I was just in a state of survival, I feel like. And, you know, I didn't have the education that I do now. So.
Well, and having Cervidil and Cytotec and Pitocin.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I did not last long. I was 4 centimeters and 70% effaced when I requested the epidural. And, you know, I knew I was supposed to change position, but I think I was using the peanut ball laying on my side. And then like they'd come and help me roll to my side. Just that was all I was doing. It wasn't like I was getting into any other different positions.
Yeah.
And so about 8:30 that night, I was at about 6 centimeters, but I started to tell everybody like, I'm starting to feel some pressure. I'm starting to feel some pain. And at the beginning I was like, I don't want to redose my epidural because I want to be able to feel a little bit because I couldn't feel anything last time. And I had such a hard time pushing.
Right.
Like if I could feel a little bit, I can handle it. So at first I was like, it's okay. But then it very quickly got so much worse. It felt like torture. So my epidural was working and then stopped working. And I was having really irregular contractions, which now I know can happen with Pitocin. But I remember the nurse making comments like, these are strange contractions. They were like back to back and one on top of the other. Like I wouldn't come all the way down from one when I was having another one. And so at this point, the epidural wasn't working at all. And I kept telling them, I was that person you see in the movies that you could hear screaming down the hall. I was in pain. I felt like I was dying. They came in and tried to redose the epidural and they'd be like, in 20 minutes, you should be feeling so much better. And so I'd go through all of those contractions. I wasn't getting much of a break, not feeling any better at all. Mm-hmm. But every redose, my blood pressure would drop. So I'd start to pass out. They'd have to push me with more, whatever medications to help. I'd be talking to my husband like, this is so painful. And then I'd just start slurring and kind of going off and my blood pressure would be dropping. But the epidural redose wasn't working to help my pain. Mm-hmm. So they did. I want to say it's hard to remember. I feel like they redosed at least 3 times before they finally had the anesthetist come in and like look at the catheter and it was dislodged. So it had moved. It wasn't even in place where it needed to be, which is why it wasn't working. I'm like, yeah, where did all these redoses go? I don't know.
Yeah. I've had a client that's had that happen. It was the second dose. And I'm like, hey, can we like sit you, like, let's look at this. And we sat her up and I was like, no, that's not going into you.
Yes. Yeah. So they finally figured that out. I mean, this was at least 2 or 3 hours of this going back and forth of like, I was miserable and pain. So, I should mention too, this entire time, you know, they have me NPO, I'm not eating anything. So here we are. I went in Sunday night. This is Monday night that this is all happening. And they finally replaced the epidural. And I want to say it was about midnight before I finally started feeling pain relief again. But I was exhausted. I had used all of my energy, wasn't eating. And so I think she came in and checked me and I was 8 centimeters, but my cervix was very swollen and I had a swollen anterior lip that was really concerning. I also forgot to mention in my first, I had an anterior lip that wouldn't go away, but I pushed past it. And so this time she said that again, but she said, your cervix is really swollen though. And I said, well, I pushed past the lip last time. Mm-hmm. So we decided on giving Benadryl and trying to rest. And she also said baby was ROT. So
looking transverse.
Yes. She tried to go in and help her move her head and she couldn't get her to move. So she wasn't in a great position. And I can't remember. They broke my water at some point and I don't remember exactly when that happened, but I think at this point it had already been broken. Mm-hmm. So I was told to rest, given Benadryl, you know, here I am traumatized by what just happened. That it was, mm-hmm. it was like torture. And so I'm attempting to rest. My husband goes to sleep. He's sleeping next to me. And, you know, I can hear the baby's heart rate on the monitors. And I'm sitting there just attempting to go to sleep. I could not go to sleep, but all of a sudden I heard a big change in the heart rate and it sounded like it dropped really quiet and low and was really slow. And then I sit up and I'm trying to wake up my husband and I'm like, Alex, I think there's something wrong. And as soon as I said that, he was still half asleep, the room filled with people. So I don't even know. I feel like there was 20 people in there. There was a whole team of nurses and the OB and multiple other people. I was so out of it at this point, but they put me on oxygen. They were changing me into what felt like every position imaginable to try to get her heart rate to come up. And, you know, I've looked back on my records from that and they had recorded recurring late D cells with multiple 2 to 3 minute heart rate drops into the 70s.
Whoa.
So it was a scary situation. My poor husband got just kind of pushed aside and he was just waking up. He was so like, what is going on? Yeah. Kind of got pushed aside and I didn't know what was happening. They were just like trying to get her in a mm-hmm. different position. Mm-hmm. At this point, she was like, you're still at 8, maybe 9. I can't really tell because you're so swollen, but I'm going to let you try to push if we can't get this baby out. Like, and if her heart rate doesn't come up, it's, mm-hmm. we're going to have to make a decision. So she let me try, I want to say like 3 pushes. And she said, she is stuck in that position. Her heart rate is not coming up. We need to go do a C-section. So by this point, it was around 2 a.m. I was just depleted. I was so medicated. I was so exhausted from everything that had happened leading up to this. They took me to the C-section. I remember crying and I was very upset about it. And I had not prepared in any way, shape or form for a C-section because mm-hmm. I had a vaginal birth the first time. But like, there's no reason. Yeah. Like I didn't think that would happen. They didn't cover C-sections in the hospital class at all. And this time I was like, I'm going to be more prepared for postpartum. And I got all my mm-hmm. supplies and everything. And and I also prepared a little bit more for like how to push and those sort of things. But what I didn't prepare for was, of course, what happened. So we went back for the C-section. It was urgent. And I just remember being on that table. I felt so sick. I felt horrible. I felt so detached from the experience. I didn't even care at that point. I was like, just get her out. I'm so exhausted. I remember being really nauseous and just the whole experience was just, I felt like things were being done to me and I was just not even present. It's almost like I was watching it at some, from some other perspective. Like I wasn't that baby's mom. Like I don't know how else to explain. So she was born and thankfully was healthy after all of that. I didn't get to hold her. I didn't get to do skin to skin. I also forgot to mention she was so far in my pelvis that they had to push her back up to even get her out. So yeah, it was just not the experience that I had wanted. And you know, people kept saying, oh, your second's supposed to be easier. This is weird. And I'm like, this is not helpful in this moment. Yeah. I feel like I remember the nurse talking to the OB and like that there's so much fluid in there. I can't, I'm like, why is there so much fluid? And she said, I think she had polyhydramnios, which I didn't have leading up to that because I was having weekly ultrasounds to measure.
Yeah, and they never said anything.
They never, it was always normal. So I don't know if it was, I don't know. I had an IV fluid for this whole process. I don't know what causes that, but, and they never talked to me about it afterwards. I just remember hearing that in the OR and them like being like, oh gosh, this is a mess. Super swollen, lots of fluid. And, you know, their official diagnosis of why they did a C-section was the non-reassuring fetal heart tones and then arrest of dilation and then cephalopelvic disproportion because of her positioning.
Yeah, because she was looking sideways instead of tucked and down. Yeah.
So that was that birth. And recovery, this was in November of 2021. So COVID was coming back around. It was like a resurgence at that time where there was a high number of cases in our area and things were shutting down again. I couldn't have any visitors in the hospital or anything other than my husband. Thankful he was able to be there, but recovery just started out was horrible, very brutal. You know, you've done C-sections, you know, but especially when you've been through such a traumatic labor first, tried to push.
And pregnancy. It's not just your labor. It's all the pregnancy and all the hurdles that you had to jump through then. And then that the birth and then or the labor and then the birth and now postpartum being alone again.
Yes. Yeah.
And so recovering.
All of that. And then you'd think I'd get to recovery and things would start going smoothly, but I had an allergic reaction to the sutures that they used. So. So, you know, they're supposed to dissolve, but instead of dissolving for months after I gave birth, they were working their way out through my skin and it was really irritated and it kept reopening because they were like pushing their way out. They said it was
injecting them.
Yep. Allergic reaction. So then I had to deal with that. I will say my heart rate started to come down as soon as I gave birth, like in the hospital, it started to come down. So that was good. Mm-hmm. So anyways, all of this stuff had happened and I wasn't even mentally prepared to be pregnant again. And all of this happened and I was mentally not in a good space after she was born. The postpartum anxiety was through the roof and then depression hit me hard this time. And this is finally like when that got really bad, what led me to seek out mental health therapy. So I started working with a psychologist and I was having nightmares. It was horrible. She diagnosed me with PTSD from that experience. And we worked through that with EMDR, which was very helpful. It was exhausting, but it worked well. After a few sessions, I stopped having nightmares. And
hey, Women of Strength, I want to talk about one of the companies we wholeheartedly love and feel you should know about. It's a company called Needed. Needed was created by two mothers and trained nutritionists who knew there had to be a better way when it comes to women's health. When I found out about Needed, I was immediately inspired by their passion and drive to help women all over. They've developed high-quality supplements that support women before, during, and after pregnancy. And they didn't just stop there. They have also created products designed to support dads and kids because the whole family's health matters. The women behind Needed are truly change makers. They've brought together a collective of over 10,000 practitioners who work with them on everything from education to product development, and they've set a radically better standard for women's health. We are so grateful for the work they are doing. And here's the best part. Our amazing community gets 20% off your first order. Just use the code VBAC at checkout when you head over to thisisneeded.com. Again, that is code VBAC, V-B-A-C, for 20% off your first order at thisisneeded.com. We love Needed so much, and we know you will too.
You know, I kept doing it for a long time and finally, you know, got into a better mental space. And I also returned to pelvic floor PT because here I am trying to recover from a C-section that I had not knew nothing about, didn't prepare for. And I feel like at that point too, there wasn't such wide talk about all of that on social media and things. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's more information out there now. It's more accessible. So I was just, you know, trying to recover. Yeah. Anyways, so pelvic floor PT and EMDR therapy just really was helpful. So I, at this point, was devastated. I was like, I can't have another kid. There's no way that I could ever do that again. And, you know, my husband and I have always wanted, you know, 3 or 4 kids, and we both have big families. We love our big families and just can't imagine it any other way. So this was something that was really hard and I just could not let go of. And so, you know, I worked really hard in therapy. I worked really hard to physically regain my strength, and I did consistent strength training. I started running again. And then I ran a half marathon in spring of 2024.
Congrats.
Yeah, thank you. It was just something to me that was like, if I'm working really hard towards this goal and can recover my body from such a difficult experience.
Really? Yeah.
So I finally, when I was training for that, I was like, if I can do this, like I feel like I'm going to be ready to try again. Like mentally, I felt like I was in a space that I started feeling like I would regret not having a third baby more than I would regret having one and going through another difficult experience. Mm-hmm. So I did my half marathon, and then right afterwards I was like, all right, I think I'm ready. Let's do it. Like, let's go for our third. So I found out I was pregnant with our third baby at the beginning of August of 2024, after about 2 months of trying. And I was so excited, but I was also very nervous, just knowing what was ahead of me. But this is when I started researching, and I came across the VBAC link and began listening to the podcast pretty obsessively. My husband was like, you are obsessed. And I was like, yeah, I am, but it's for a good reason. I tried to focus on really staying active through this pregnancy because I was in such a good routine of physical activity. And I was like, if I can just keep up with my routine, I mean, I have to modify obviously, but again, the vomiting, nausea, exhaustion started very early. And at 9 weeks, it got so bad that I couldn't even keep water down for, it was almost 2 days. So I ended up in the hospital with dehydration. Mm-hmm. I would take sips of water and immediately throw it up within the next 2 minutes. Gosh. Yeah. My stomach was just rejecting everything.
Yeah.
So at this point they diagnosed me with hyperemesis. It took until this third pregnancy and being hospitalized was what that finally got the diagnosis.
Finally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And looking back, I'm like, if I would have been hot, like gone to the hospital, I know I was dehydrated at points. Like I just was able to, I don't know.
Able to keep it down.
Yes. Yeah. Very frustrating. So I was diagnosed with hyperemesis. I started Zofran at 9 weeks. In Zofran, I did the Diclegis, or which is the Unisom and B6 and Finagrin. I was on all of these medications to help. I still vomited from time to time, but it wasn't constant and I was keeping food down. Yeah. And I had to take my medicines around the clock, like middle of the night, I had to get up and take Zofran or else I would wake up throwing up, which the more research I did, the more I found like that is important to do if you have hyperemesis, is to take your medications around the clock and not just like go to sleep, and because it's better managed if you do that. So I did a lot of research on hyperemesis this time, and I found the hyperemesis, the HER Foundation, and they put out, it's the leading researcher on hyperemesis, and they put out the newest information and everything. It's a very helpful website, and they have a nice Instagram page and everything, that they recommend taking a vitamin B1 supplement because you can get so easily depleted when you have hyperemesis, and it's very important for fetal development, but also your own brain health. So I go in and ask my OB about it, and he's like, you can do it. We don't usually do it. It's not going to hurt you. And I'm like, okay. But it's this is what the people researching it say, like, why don't you do it? So I started taking it. I feel like it helped me energy wise feel a little bit better. And I really focused on getting protein, and that helped with the nausea. So I was better managing it this time, because I had more information. And at this point I had had enough of doctors just being like, you'll be fine. So I started to take it.
That's so frustrating to me.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's like, even through pregnancy, we're oftentimes like depleted already.
Yes.
And now you're really like, you are physically depleting your body.
Yeah.
Like you can see it. And they're still like, no, you're fine.
You don't need just take the Zofran. You're good.
And you're like, but no, my body probably needs these nutrients. My baby, yes. My brain, everything.
Yes. Yeah. So I was much better this time about doing my own research and advocating for myself and doing what was better for me. So it started with this. That's what it started with, was the hyperemesis. And I hit second trimester and I hired a doula. And again, a lot of this information is coming from hearing your podcast and just knowing how important that was. And I said, I will feel so much better if I just have somebody there to support me. And, you know, I don't have my logical brain when I'm in labor. I have a labor brain, so I need somebody to like talk me through what to do. I can research all I want, but as soon as I'm in labor, I'm sure it'll go out the window. So I did hire a doula, and they were helpful like throughout the whole pregnancy. When different things came up, I was able to, you know, ask them questions. And one of them was studying to become a midwife. And so she had a lot of helpful like information when I would hear something from the OB, and she wasn't giving me medical advice.
Yeah, sounding board for you to be like, hey, this is what's being said. What have you found or what have you seen?
Yeah. And she would provide me with research. She would, which is what the doctors should do, but they just are set in their ways. And kind of my experience was a few of the ones that I had talked to were kind of set in their ways and like, well, this is what we've been doing for 30 years. This is not set. But she would give me the research and not tell me what to do, but it was such a valuable resource.
Empower you with education.
Yes.
And so you can make the best decision for you and your baby.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was just very helpful. So, you know, I am better managing the hyperemesis. I feel like I got to about 20 weeks. I started having contractions early on this time. And I forgot to mention this, but I also had a lot of contractions with my last pregnancy. And I started them just having them earlier this time. Like, I want to say 13, 14 weeks I started with. It felt like
Braxton Hicks?
It felt like Braxton Hicks contractions.
Okay.
But they were happening so frequently that they were like, I don't know, we have to keep an eye on this. And I feel like around 20 weeks, they sent me to triage because I was having pretty regular ones, like every 5 minutes or so. And they were lasting like a minute long. And so they started Procardia to help with that. But otherwise, like, I was used to the contractions. That wasn't bothering. It's not like stopping me in pain. It wasn't like labor contractions.
Yeah.
But they said, try to take it a little easier. And I was like, well, I feel like I know my body and like, these are not doing anything. They would check me and I wouldn't have any cervical changes or anything. And I was like, I'm going to keep being physically active as long as it doesn't make my contractions worse. Mm-hmm. So I continued with that. I was still working, still going to the gym, still being active with my kids, and everything was going very well for how my pregnancies have gone.
Yeah.
So then we get to, let's see, I think it was 31 weeks maybe, and I got the flu, which wasn't fun, but it's the, like, it happens. And oh, I forgot to mention too, that this whole time as I'm mentally preparing, I am questioning every doctor, like, I want a VBAC. Can I do a VBAC? What happens if I need to be induced? Even though I had my heart set, I am not being induced this time. I am mentally preparing to go past my due date. I'm going to fight for that. I don't, like, I had listened to your podcast enough and heard so many stories, and just, I was like, I want to experience going into labor and staying at home as long as possible. And then not having to spend so much time in the hospital. And my heart was set on this. So get to 31 weeks, I get the flu. And then about a week after I had the flu, I started with itching on my hands and my feet. And it was a Saturday. And I remember I was at my daughter's ice skating. She was taking ice skating lessons. I was at my daughter's ice skating, and it's really cold in there. And I was like, gosh, am I just cold? Like, is that why I'm feeling like my hands are dry? It's the winter. Like, this is strange. But I had it in the back of my mind because I had been listening to your podcast. And specifically, I remember, shout out to Aubrey, that she shared her story about cholestasis. I had it kind of just in the back of my mind, but I was like, I don't want to freak out yet. I'm cold. My hands are dry. My feet are dry. I'll just put some lotion on, see how it goes. And it was kind of
a warm environment.
Yeah, it was coming and going that whole day. And I was like, this is starting to stress me out, but it's okay. I was like, I don't want to freak out over nothing. This is silly. Right. Like, it's just an itch. Like, it's okay. And so that night, it got way worse overnight. It kept me up most of that night. And the itching became pretty intense.
Unbearable.
Uh-huh. So I wake up the next morning. It's not as bad as it was overnight, but it still was there. I was still itching. And then I was getting in my head and I was like, the baby's not moving quite as much as he normally does. I'm not sure. I was very nervous. It was a weekend. So I was like, I think I called the on-call nurse who for the OB practice that I was going to is just like a nurse in the hospital. It's not an OB nurse. So I told her, I was like, I've got really bad itching on my hands and feet. And she's like, well, I don't know. Did you try some lotion? Like, she didn't know. I don't think she knew.
Yeah, she's not educated in that. Yeah.
I knew what it was. So I was kind of leading her, like, should I go to triage or can this wait until I go to the doctor? I can go to the doctor tomorrow. Yeah. Like, I didn't know enough about cholestasis to know if it was like an urgent situation or she didn't know either. So I ended up going into triage. And they did the blood work and it came back positive. They test your bile acids and I did have cholestasis. So this came out of nowhere. I had been doing so well. I was so like proud of myself for how good this pregnancy was going and how hard I was working to get my V back.
Yeah.
And I had never had cholestasis in either of my previous pregnancies. And so this really hit me hard. It came out of nowhere. And the doctors immediately were like, we're going to have to do really, really tight monitoring and you're not likely to have a VBAC at this point. We're going to have to do a C-section. Like, we won't induce you for a VBAC. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but I already talked to one of, like, this is a practice where there's like multiple OBs. Yes. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, one of them, I had already talked to him and he did say, if I was favorable, if something came up, that they would induce me. And I had questioned for a long time whether or not to stay with this OB practice, but I felt like I had relationships with a few of the OBs, like that they respected me enough, like they knew me and would listen to me. I did. I actually did call a midwife group, but they wouldn't take me because I was a VBAC. So I was kind of flip-flopping back and forth. And then we get to this point and I'm like, oh gosh, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I'm being told, no, you can't even try. We're not going to induce a VBAC. That's too dangerous. But I, again, thanks to the VBAC link, I had done my research and I knew, I was like, I know that that's not the case. And I know that this is my risk and I am willing to take that on. It's still like 1% risk of rupture. Like I'm willing to accept that. And, you know, there was multiple of the OBs that were like, I won't do it. Like I know at least one of them had said he had had a previous bad experience. It's no sure. fault to him.
He held on to that. And
yes. And, yeah. you know, I can't say I wouldn't either. Like he's a person too. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And yeah. That, honestly, it's what happens a lot of the times in the medical mm-hmm. world where they see yeah. one bad experience and they kind of lump everybody into that and stop yeah. doing that or whatever. And it's not just VBAC, like just other yeah. things. They're like, nope, I used to do that. Didn't have a good outcome. We're not doing it. And that's what is hard for me. Cause it's like, yes, you had a bad experience, mm-hmm. but everyone's not the same.
Yes. Yes, exactly. But it was like, no convincing them. Like I would say, but this is what the stats are. This is what yeah. the research is. And I know I have a good chance. Mm-hmm. Every doctor I've asked said, I mean, I've had a previous successful vaginal birth. Not that you can't do it if you don't have that, but I had mm-hmm. good odds because of mm-hmm. all of these things. And every doctor had said that. So why? And there's safe induction methods. So,
yeah.
But there was a few that just, they'd listen to me and then they'd say, okay, we'll see. Like, yeah. mm-hmm. and they would give me like a sympathy look, like it's not happening. Oh goodness. So at this point I had bi-weekly lab work, like blood work that I had to draw. I had 24-hour urines every week. I had bi-weekly non-stress tests. I had a weekly ultrasound, weekly OB appointments, but they were also like trigger happy in sending me to triage because cholestasis comes with a risk of stillbirth. So anything that looked a little bit off, I was in triage.
Yeah.
So they'd say, pack your bags, go into triage. I'd think, oh my gosh, I have to have this baby today. And then they'd do more labs and my liver numbers would come down or something. And they'd be like, okay, we're good. But just mentally, that was very hard.
Roller coaster.
There was at least probably four times that I got sent to triage that they were mm-hmm. like, we don't know, you might have to deliver. We're trying to weigh the benefits of the baby mm-hmm. staying in versus out. So I was having just a hard time with that. And I was still very itchy, not sleeping. I did start the ursodiol medication that's supposed to help. And it might have decreased my itch a little bit, but it was still keeping me up at night. It didn't work miraculously or anything.
Yeah.
I was still, and at this point, the itching had been more widespread. It wasn't just my hands and my feet anymore. My scalp was itchy. My whole body was itchy. Mm-hmm. I would sit every night with like ice packs on my feet and hands mm-hmm. and take cold showers every night. Those were the only things that seemed to help temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Reducing some inflammation and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did change my diet just a little bit. Like I tried to eat less. I don't eat a ton of fried foods and processed foods, but I took away those things completely. Like mm-hmm. no more, like every once in a while when we would eat out or something, I'm not getting French fries. I'm not getting fried foods. Mm-hmm. I'm not. So I tried to eat like as healthy as possible without stressing myself out too much about like, oh, I can't yeah. eat certain things. They do recommend just like a whole foods diet. My doctor didn't recommend that. I found ICP care, which is the intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy awareness group, nonprofit, that their website has a lot of valuable information that I gained a lot of this information and things to try from. So that's what I was doing at this point. I did stop working because I was not sleeping. I was mm-hmm. very stressed. I kept being told it is so important to do your kit counts. That is the most important thing that you need to do right now because, you know, even though they're doing all of these non-stress tests and things, it hasn't been shown that that doesn't predict stillbirth. So in like the research that's been done in cholestasis, mm-hmm. they could have a perfectly normal non-stress test and then still have a stillbirth later that day. Mm-hmm. So while it's the best that they can do, mm-hmm. it doesn't predict what will happen. And so I was very stressed about doing my kit counts, which at work is very hard to do with how active I am in like lifting and doing things. And I don't have time to sit down and see, I don't know, I'm distracted. So luckily my employer was very understanding and they basically told me, I think it's time that you just take off and relax, which ended up being a good thing because I got sent to triage again and my like liver numbers were like really high. And they started coming down about a week after I stopped working. So my OB was like, are you like less stressed? Are you less stressed now? And I'm like, well, I stopped working, so that's probably related. And they're like, I think that's probably helping you out with your like the inflammatory response probably. So that was good. And then I get to 35 weeks and I'm being told different times of delivery by all the different OBs. And I happened to get a newer OB who I didn't know as well. And she was amazing. She listened to me. She gave me information and helped empower my own decision about what was going on. And then she got together, like outside of our appointment, she said, I'm going to talk to these. I had found two other doctors in the practice that were willing to induce. And so my plan was to get scheduled with one of them. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I would induce you. And so she got together with those doctors and made a plan and said, she called me like herself, not a nurse. She called me and said, this is the plan. I'm going to change your 36-week appointment to be with me. I'm going to check you. If you look even a little bit favorable, like then we can schedule the induction. If not, we're going to have to do the C-section. And they were planning for 37 weeks as long as my labs stayed stable. Mm-hmm. So I go to my 36-week appointment. It's a big deal. This is like make it or break it.
Yeah.
And I was just shaking with excitement because she checked me. I was 1 centimeter and 70% effaced already. Yay. And, you know, I had been doing all of the things, curb walking, dates, tea, you name it. I did it. And I don't know if that's what worked or if I just, my body was ready. But so I went in at 37 weeks. It happened to work out that she was on call at the hospital that day. Like she was the one on the schedule. It was meant to be.
Yeah.
She was the one on the schedule. She had me come in and we started the induction about 9 a.m. And, you know, I had asked, thanks to your podcast again, about a Foley bulb. Mm-hmm. And so I had never had one before and I'd been induced 2 times. And I was like, I'd really like to try that. And so she placed the Foley bulb. It was about 9 a.m. and started a low and slow Pitocin, like very low. I don't think I went over 10 the whole time. And so we get to about 2 p.m. and I better prepared coping strategies and things this time. I'm having regular contractions, but I am managing fine. I'm up and moving, doing all the different positions that I learned and everything. And so she comes in about 2 p.m. and is like, I just want to check and see. You're having really consistent contractions and strong contractions. Like, I just want to check and see if that bulb is still in place because it hadn't fallen out yet. And she checked me and it had come out. It was just didn't fall all the way out. And I was at 6 centimeters. I went from a 1 to a 6 in that amount of time. And I was shocked. So that gave me, I think because previously I had such a hard time getting past 4, mm-hmm. I was at 6. That gave me such a boost of confidence.
Absolutely.
So then I kind of stalled at 6 for a while and they kept increasing the Pitocin. And so the contractions were getting more painful and I was getting more tired. I will say I was sneaking snacks this time because I was like, I could not be that exhausted.
Need energy.
Again. And this time I did my research and knew the risks about eating during mm-hmm. labor. And I was like, okay, I can do this.
Doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also will say, because I ran that half marathon and had experience with like gels that people take for quick energy during that, I packed some of those and those were helpful. So a quick light carb snack. So I'm just feeling much better this time around and managing better, but I was starting to get tired. I think when
was your doula here at that point?
So she kept saying, just let me know when you want me to come. And I was like, I'm feeling pretty good. Like, I think we can wait. And I was expecting it to take such a long time because of mm-hmm. my previous 2 inductions took so long. I was like, I don't want you to have to be here too long. I'll let you know. She wasn't here yet, but it started getting pretty painful. So I called her, but she was an hour away. So I know we live like near Cincinnati, which there was a lot of traffic. It was around rush hour. It was not great. And so let's see, around 6 p.m. I hadn't changed from 6 centimeters, which I know can happen, but I was also like in so much pain at that point that I could feel my whole body tensing. I was not able to relax my pelvic floor. That tends to be my response to pain is tensing. And I was doing my strategies. I could not relax and it was getting really painful. So I did ask for the epidural at that point. I needed to rest. I knew I was running out of energy.
Yeah.
And so my doula came right before they did the epidural. I was like, I have to give in. Yeah. We tried like a few coping things and I was like the spiky ball or cone. And I was like, these things are not working.
Yeah. You're past that so point.
It was my fault that I called her too late, but.
No, but doulas are still really, really helpful even with epidurals. Yeah.
Yes. I will say that she came, she dimmed the lights. She hung up like fairy twinkle lights in the room. She made it such a calming environment and she was so supportive for the rest of the time. And then the night nurse came on and she was amazing. I was her only patient that night.
Yeah.
It was super, I know, she was super attentive and she came in so frequently and was changing my positions. And I asked for a low dose epidural. And so I could still feel pretty, mm-hmm. I could still move myself in the bed pretty well. Like I didn't really need much help, but she was telling me like what position to get in, and her and my doula worked so well together. They were like a dream team. And the nurse also was just like encouraging me and updating me on things that she was seeing on the monitors that really were helping me. I'm getting closer.
Yeah.
My epidural did start to wear off. I did have a redose and it wasn't really working very well, which started for a moment. I was like panicky a little bit, like, oh no,
a little PTSD, this doesn't happen, I'm like, sure.
Time. Yeah. But I, again, had my coping mechanisms this time, which I never had prepared before. I had my affirmations and things and mm-hmm. a better environment, better support. And so while I could feel most of everything, I don't know, my nurse said, I feel like afterwards, she said, I feel like your epidural was only working at like 20% of what it should have been doing. But I don't know where she got that number. It was just, I think she was observing what I was doing. And I had never before gotten like the shakes, and I was able to feel so much pressure and the urge to push. And at that point, like I started shivering and started dry heaving. I've always vomited during my labors. But and I was telling the nurse what I was feeling and she was like, oh, it's time. Like I can tell. Mm-hmm. So she called the OB in and it was 10:45 at this point. And she checked me and she's like, yep, you're ready to push. And so I could feel everything, which was hard, but it also was cool that I could feel the baby mm-hmm. moving down as I was pushing. And I pushed him out in 7 minutes and,
wow.
and no tears. And wow. I got immediate skin to skin. They put him on me and it was just immediately magical. Like, I don't know how else to describe, you know, I felt so empowered. Recovery was so much easier. I got this golden multiple hours of being with my baby. I was present. And I did want to mention, he did have a little bit of breathing. Like they had to suction him a lot, a little stunned when he came out, but they did it while he was on my chest. They didn't have to take him away. Respiratory issues is one of the things that can happen in babies with cholestasis pregnancies. That's one of the risks, but I was thankful he didn't have to spend any time in the NICU or anything. They were able to take care of him. And so, yeah, that is my successful VBAC story. I was in tears of happiness. My husband knew how hard I had worked. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, we were just both in tears of like, we did it. Like he's here, healthy. I didn't have to have a C-section. And
I'm sure it was healing for him too, to see.
Yeah.
I mean, the last birth was probably really rocky for him, like mm-hmm. coming out of a half awake, half asleep state to craziness to everything. And then, you know, all the things to have this and then also see you really, really work and strive for a better experience and then having one. Yeah. Even despite cholestasis and some other, you know, the flu and, you know, other little hurdles, you were able to like still have this path.
Yes.
What you wanted, you know,
overall.
And I know you didn't go into spontaneous labor and there were some things that on that list that maybe weren't achieved.
Yes. I had to compromise, but I did get my ultimate goal.
Yes.
You know, I did. When I was the original diagnosis of cholestasis, I was in tears. I was losing hope at that point. Mm-hmm. I thought there's no way.
Yeah.
And I really have to thank the VBAC link. Like I've mm-hmm. mentioned it multiple times throughout this episode, but I just got so much information. I felt empowered to educate myself and advocate for myself and just make my experience what I wanted it to be. And then I also obviously have to thank my amazing doulas and nurse and my therapist that mentally helped me prepare, and my pelvic floor PT, and of course my husband and my family. They were always so supportive, and it ended up being a magical experience, and I still can't stop raving about it.
Well, I am so happy for you. I mean, when Julie and I started this podcast in 2018, I mean, that's really what we wanted to create, is that space where people can come and share, be vulnerable as well, and feel safe to be vulnerable, but then also empower.
Yes.
And guide, and then obviously educate, and just create that community to bring people up from, and not always traumatic experiences, right? Like they don't always have to be traumatic births that they're coming off of, but overall having a better experience, no matter what that looks like. And like you said, like, even though you didn't get everything you wanted along the way, like you made some compromising, you had some compromising happen, but you still were able to get your end goal and have that better experience, and have the support and the people coming and gathering around you, and then randomly getting this, you know, OB that you didn't have this whole pregnancy, you know, it's just the stars aligned exactly how they were supposed to be. And you have to give yourself a good pat on the back, because you know that you willed that, and you educated yourself. You found the links, which, guys, we're going to make sure this podcast is going to have a lot of show note links for education, including kick counts. We actually have a blog on that, because that can get confusing and overwhelming too. So we have a blog on the kick counts as well. So yeah, you should be so proud of yourself.
Thank you.
Such an honor to be here with you today and listening to your story. And I'm so glad that you've been with us the whole time. Binge listening, even if your husband's like, you're obsessed. You're like, it's a healthy obsession, okay?
Yes,
it's a healthy obsession.
It was worth it. It was worth it.
Yes. And, you know,
I feel very honored to be sharing my story, just with how helpful listening to everybody else's stories before me was. And hopefully it's helpful.
Yeah. And just to know, like, VBAC still is possible with cholestasis or, you know, weird arrhythmias in our hearts and like things. Even though that was the pregnancy you did have a cesarean, but like we have to like dive in and educate ourselves, and then it still can be possible with all of these hurdles thrown our way. Yes. So
which if I wasn't listening to the VBAC link, I would have given up hope. Probably I would have been like, oh, they're telling me I have to have a C-section like this. Yeah. I would have gone down that road probably. So just very thankful.
It's easy to, just like with your first pregnancy where they're like, there's this and there's that. And then there's a lot of fear mongering going on, and you're like, ah, okay. Overwhelming. And really there wasn't a lot of research or known things at that time with that specific situation, but we hear these professionals say, this is what you need to do. And if we don't question or we don't educate, it's easy to be like, okay.
Yes, exactly. I feel like I am an educated person, and I still had no idea the first two pregnancies what I was doing. I can't believe that I had two pregnancies and didn't have this information. I just trusted that what they were saying was the case. So
was fact. Yeah.
Definitely important to get the education.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories and educating us.
Yes. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Would you like to be a guest on the podcast? Head over to thevbacklink.com/share to submit your story. For information on all things VBAC, including online and in-person VBAC classes, the VBAC blog, the worldwide database for VBAC doulas, and more, head over to thevbacklink.com. Congratulations on starting your journey of learning and discovery with the VBAC Link.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a quick sec to thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. We are so glad that you are here. This community is near and dear to our heart. We love you all so much. If you enjoyed today's episode, we would really appreciate it if you'd leave us a rating and review. Our whole team here at the VBAC Link actually gets to see these reviews come in, and it makes our day. A 5-star rating helps us share our podcast and gets these important messages out there. Thank you so much for listening, and we cannot wait to see you next time.